it is Thursday, April 30th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is defending the Iran war as a way to stop Tehran from becoming another North Korea. More on that in News Briefing. On In Depth, we discuss how Coupang's massive data breach affecting 33.7 million users has escalated into a wider regulatory, trade and diplomatic dispute between Seoul and Washington. And on Explore Korea, we look at Arang, a new musical based on an ancient Korean folktale, blending inkwash animation, traditional music and dramatic choreography. Let's start Korea 24 right now.
This war, you just said, 60 days ago, because the nuclear weapon was an imminent threat. Now you're saying that it was completely obliterated?
They had not given up their nuclear ambitions, and they had a conventional shield of thousands
of... So Operation Midnight Hammer accomplished moment, nothing of substance. It left
missing,
us at exactly
the
same
point.
Place we were before.
Amid mounting pressure to get out of the Iran war, U.S. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth confronted skeptical Democrats at the House Armed Services Committee, arguing that the U.S. military action is preventing Iran from becoming another nuclear North Korea. Let's take a listen to what he said.
And they're building a conventional shield.
All right, let me try again.
It's the North Korea strategy. You know this very well. The North Korea strategy was use conventional missiles to prevent anybody from challenging them so they could slow walk their way to a weapon. President Trump saw Iran at its weakest moment, took an action to ensure, in a way that only the United States of America could do with our Israeli partners,
and yet
to ensure
they
their...
Our KBS World Radio News reporter, Bae-Gion, joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on the Middle East conflict, as well as other headlines of the day. Hello, Gion.
Hello, Alana.
So Hegseth characterized the case of North Korea as a lesson for policymakers. Can you tell us more about what he said?
Hegseth compared Iran's nuclear ambitions to those of North Korea and characterized Pyongyang's missile program as a lesson in an effort to justify the war in Iran. Hegseth told a House Armed Services Committee hearing that Tehran's nuclear ambitions had continued even after Washington bombed and obliterated its facilities last year, characterizing the approach as the North Korea strategy of using conventional missiles to deter challenges and slow walk their way to a weapon.
Now, Hegseth's remarks ironically came amid concerns that the protracted war in the Middle East could lead to reduced U.S. military strength on the Korean Peninsula and weakened deterrence against North Korea's fast-evolving threats.
Yes, that's right. Just on Wednesday, Trump's remarks about the possible reduction of U.S. troops in Germany sparked concerns that the U.S. might do the same for its troops in Korea. On Wednesday, Trump said in a social media post that the United States is studying and reviewing the possible reduction of troops in Germany, with a determination to be made over the next short period of time.
Has there been a response from Seoul on Trump's remarks?
Yes, the presidential office said Thursday that there have been no discussions between Seoul and Washington on reducing or withdrawing U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. Presidential spokesperson Kang Yoo-jung told reporters that the government is closely monitoring the U.S.'s review of its global force posture and the possibility of related changes. Kang added that the government is working closely with the U.S. military to ensure that U.S. forces in South Korea maintain a stable presence and continue to contribute to the strong combined defense posture between the two allies.
Meanwhile, the U.S. is set to continue its naval blockade on Iranian ports, right?
Yes, the U.S. blockade of Iranian ports is expected to continue as the White House is seeking to exert maximum economic pressure on Tehran. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday after canceling his negotiator's weekend trip to Islamabad, Trump discussed a pressure campaign that his administration is calling Operation Economic Fury. Let's listen to what he said.
They're not going to have a nuclear weapon. They know it. And just about everybody else does.
President, Iran, how long are you prepared to maintain the blockade? Could that go several more months?
Well, the blockade is genius, okay? The blockade has been 100% foolproof. It shows how good our Navy is, I can tell you that. Nobody's going to play games. We have the greatest military...
In an interview with the U.S. news website Axios, Trump said the naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is more effective than airstrikes.
Meanwhile, Iran's armed forces have vowed to take practical and unprecedented action against the continued U.S. naval blockade of its ports, defining it as America's maritime piracy and banditry. Let's now turn to some economic news. Despite the war in Iran, South Korea's industrial output, retail sales and facility investment all rose in March. Ji-yeon, give us the numbers.
According to the Data Ministry's monthly industrial statistics report released Thursday, industrial production edged up 0.3% from the previous month to 118.3 in March. The gains were led by finance, insurance, transportation, and storage in the service industry, which jumped 1.4%, and automobiles and other areas in mining and manufacturing, which rose 0.3%.
And staying on economic stories, Samsung Electronics announced record earnings for the second consecutive quarter in the wake of the semiconductor super cycle. Ji-yeon, just how much are we talking?
In a press release on Thursday, the company reported an operating profit of 57.2 trillion won, or around 38.5 billion U.S. dollars in the January to March period. That's more than eightfold from a year earlier. Sales jumped 69.2% to 133.9 trillion won, with net profit surging nearly sixfold to 47.2 trillion won. Samsung posted record quarterly sales and operating profit, beating the previous highs from 3 months earlier. The tech giant attributed the record performance to robust sales of high-margin AI chips and rising memory prices.
Shifting gears now to some political news, President Lee Jae-myung has urged companies to view their workers as valuable partners and encourage labor unions to adopt a sense of mutual responsibility.
Yes, during a meeting with senior aides at Cheongwadae on Thursday, Lee warned that excessive demands from labor unions could ultimately be detrimental to both the unions and their members. His comments came as a major labor union at Samsung Electronics has threatened to initiate an 18-day general strike starting May 21st, demanding higher bonuses in line with the company's record high revenue. He emphasized the need for a spirit of coexistence and cooperation at a time of critical challenges as the transition to artificial intelligence is exposing the labor and industrial sectors to a fundamental change.
And for our last story, the government has begun taking steps to improve its E9 visa for non-professional employment. What is the purpose of these steps?
To increase benefits for higher-skilled foreign workers and better manage workforce supply and demand. KBS learned on Wednesday that the Labor Ministry is in discussions with related ministries about the possibility of creating E9 1, 2, or 3 subcategories. Under the plan, workers who improve their skills, for example, by obtaining job-related certificates, could move to a higher tier and enjoy greater benefits such as ease restrictions on changing jobs and the ability to bring their families over. The Foreign Employment Permit System, introduced in 2004, allows small and mid-sized companies to employ non-professional foreign workers if they can't fill the vacancies with South Korean nationals.
How long are foreign workers who enter the country under the system permitted to stay?
Initially, up to 4 years and 10 months on E9 visas, but this can be extended to 9 years and 8 months. During this period, changes of workplace are prohibited in principle, with exceptions allowed only for special circumstances such as unpaid wages or workplace closures. However, these tight restrictions and the prolonged separation of foreign workers from their families for over 9 years have been described as human rights violations.
And Ji-yeon, do we know how many people in South Korea are on these E9 visas?
According to the Labor Ministry, there were 282,839 people in the country on E9 visas as of December of last year, 80% of whom worked in the manufacturing sector. The ministry is expected to announce its E9 visa reform plan as early as next month.
And that's where we'll wrap up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Ji-yeon, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thanks, Alana.
I'm baritone Tae-han Kim, winner of the Queen Elizabeth competition. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Last year's huge data breach at e-commerce giant Coupang has grown into something much larger than a cybersecurity scandal. What began with the exposure of personal data belonging to 33.7 million users, or roughly two-thirds of South Korea's population, has now become a trade and diplomatic flashpoint between Seoul and Washington. South Korea has launched a pan-governmental joint investigation into the leak, while in the US, the trade representative has opened its own probe, and the House Judiciary Committee has subpoenaed Coupang over allegations of discrimination against American tech firms. Then, just yesterday, Korea's Fair Trade Commission designated Coupang founder Bom Kim as the company's controlling shareholder, a move that could tighten regulatory oversight of the US-listed e-commerce giant. So, how did one data breach escalate into a wider standoff between Seoul and Washington? To help us unpack the case and just what it means for US-Korea relations, we're joined now on the line by freelance journalist Rafael Rashid. Great to have you with us, Mr. Rashid.
Thank you for having me today.
Before we get into the diplomatic fallout, let's start with the company and the breach itself. For many people in South Korea, Coupang is not just another online retailer. It's a platform they use constantly, from groceries and household goods to next day deliveries. It's often described as the country's answer to Amazon. Today, we're talking about this massive data breach that hit the company last year. Mr. Rashid, could you remind us, you know, what exactly happened and how the public in South Korea reacted?
So, Coupang detected unauthorized access in early November last year, but the breach itself had actually been going on since roughly June, so a full 6 months before. It was found that a former engineer had kept access tokens that the company never changed or invalidated when the person left. So essentially, the person had a set of working keys to Coupang's systems months after leaving the company. When they actually disclosed what had happened at the end of November, they initially said, I believe it was around 4,500 accounts had been affected, but then this was revised later on to 33.7 million. So that's basically their entire Korean user base. And as you pointed out, that's roughly two-thirds of South Korea's population. The public response was quite, I mean, it was immediate. People started deleting their accounts en masse, deleting their accounts. There was a kind of a widespread boycott movement online as well. There were reports in the subsequent weeks and months of monthly user numbers going down. So it was definitely a kind of front page news story for a few days, if not weeks.
Absolutely. I remember those headlines. And I think, again, just the sheer scale of this breach was quite shocking. How did the South Korean government respond to the breach?
Yeah. So, if we look, say, at even President Lee Jae-myung called out Coupang a few days later, calling them out publicly without necessarily naming them, saying that, you know, when companies violate regulations and harm the public, the penalties are so weak that they break the rules like it's a routine. And then he said, if companies violate regulations, they should face economic sanctions so severe that they should think that they're going to collapse. The government itself launched a coordinated pan-governmental response, where we saw police raiding Coupang's Seoul headquarters. The National Tax Service launched a special audit. Parliament summoned executives to multiple hearings. I guess, interestingly, Bom Kim, so who's the chairman of the board at Coupang Inc., the U.S. parent company, refused to appear to any of these, citing his role as a global CEO. So instead, we had interim CEO Harold Rogers, who came in and sat through hours of interrogations and responded in English. Coupang issued an apology, but Kim's absence, I guess, became a bit of a political point. People kind of, and the government as well, kind of believe, you know, this reinforces the perception that Korean money is being taken away, but the people at the top don't want to answer to Korean institutions. So it definitely, you know, blew up quite a lot, and it's been going, it's been ongoing since then.
Mm-hmm. And as you've just mentioned, Mr. Rashid, the South Korean government reacted here by launching this pan-governmental joint investigation. We've also seen the American government get involved, the US Trade Representative opening a probe into alleged discrimination against American tech firms, including Coupang. Can you fill us in on what the US response has been to this Coupang case, and how exactly, you know, is Washington viewing the way South Korean authorities have handled it?
Yeah, I think the U.S. side, you know, if we can just sum it up, is that you guys are discriminating against a U.S. company, and you're not, for kind of similar cases of breaches, you don't go as far as you are than you're doing with Coupang, so stop discriminating. That's basically what the side is. The U.S. has, you know, they framed it as a low-sensitivity data leak, accusing Seoul of launching a whole of government assault on American companies, and this language comes directly from 54 Republican lawmakers who sent a letter to the current Korean ambassador in Washington, Kang Kyung-hwa. We've also seen U.S. investors that are pursuing arbitration under the Korea-U.S. Fair Trade Agreement. They're claiming Seoul's enforcement was disproportionate compared to similar cases. And then we have, in particular, these five big investment firms have filed notices seeking potentially billions in damages. As for Coupang, interestingly, Coupang has spent, according to public documents, over $11 million on U.S. lobbying since 2021, and that in the first quarter of this year, that spending doubled compared to the previous period, and this they've been targeting the White House, the Vice President's office, Congress. So, you know, whether or not this lobbying translated into real pressure is a big question, but I guess it is a question that needs to be asked. Coupang has denied that their lobbying has been related to putting pressure on Seoul.
So Washington is saying that this is, in fact, a disproportionate response from South Korea to this breach. This response has triggered quite a political reaction here in South Korea, with lawmakers debating whether Washington's involvement is a legitimate trade concern or pressure on Korea's regulatory and judicial sovereignty. How exactly have South Korean political parties responded to this U.S. intervention in the Coupang case?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's quite a mixed bag. A lot of emotions, of course. But in general, I think there's been quite a lot of backlash against Coupang. We saw the other day the National Assembly Speaker, Woo Won-sik, who called the letter that was sent by the Republican lawmakers to the ambassador. He said something in the lines of that this was a clear intervention or meddling in domestic affairs. Then you have a situation where, again, just the other day, I think it was over 90 lawmakers from the ruling Democratic Party, but also the Rebuilding Korea Party and Progressive Party, and also other other politicians got together. They held a press conference and they said that they will be delivering a letter of protest to the U.S. embassy, condemning, again, what they called violation of a judicial sovereignty. Of course, on the other side, you have the People Power Party. The response has been mixed. I mean, overall, I don't think they're necessarily defending Coupang per se, but they're criticizing the government for poor crisis management. PPP lawmaker Yoon Sang-hyun said that if the Coupang case is shaking, you know, the U.S.-Korea alliance, then that's a failure of government diplomacy. So stop pointing the finger otherwise. You also have the PPP leader, Jang Dong-hyuk, who, as we know, went to the U.S. recently and met some U.S. lawmakers. And when he came back, he said that Washington has a strong perception that American companies are being discriminated against compared to Chinese firms. So in response to that, the Democratic Party has been pressing done to reveal what he told the lawmakers in response, but he's refused to disclose the details of those private conversations. So again, now it's become, a domestic political mess.
Mm-hmm. And I think that as you just put it, domestic political mess, really shows how much this issue has widened from what just began as a data breach, however massive it was, and moved beyond, you know, party politics now and into the diplomatic relationship between Seoul and Washington. Last week, as you mentioned, those 54 US House representatives sent that letter to South Korean ambassador to the US, Kang Kyung-hwa, arguing that American tech firms, including Coupang, have faced this unfair regulatory and punitive action in Korea. Ambassador Kang, who was temporarily back in Seoul, she met Foreign Minister Cho Hyun to discuss pending Korea-US issues, including Coupang. Meanwhile, the foreign ministry is reportedly replacing several senior US-related posts, including at the Korean embassy in Washington, a move that comes amid this mounting friction, though some officials have framed this as part of a delayed personnel rotation. So there's some ambiguity there. Mr. Rashid, just how has this single data breach escalated into an issue involving both governments?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, the biggest thing at the moment is that this has become a so-called sovereignty flashpoint. Just the other day, we had a local Korean broadcaster reporting that the U.S. government had directly told Seoul it basically wouldn't proceed with high-level security talks, including nuclear submarines that were discussed when President Lee Jae-myung visited Washington last year. Unless South Korea guaranteed Bom Kim from Coupang wouldn't face a travel ban or be arrested when visiting Korea. Then I think there's another issue about the kind of precedent problem. Seoul fears that if they give in, so to speak, this could create a two-tier legal system where if someone has a U.S. passport, they get immunity, but Korean chaebol chairmen don't. As we all know, you know, Samsung executives have been to prison over the years, mm-hmm. and I believe now Hybe's under investigation as well. So if Bom Kim gets special treatment because of U.S. pressure, then, you know, that could cause an issue. As you mentioned, we know that Ambassador Kang, who was in Washington, was called over to fly over back to Seoul to brief the foreign minister about, you know, what's going on, about pending issues. But I think, you know, when we kind of zoom out a bit, we can see that the transactional nature of relations under the Trump administration that we've seen around the world seems to now be hitting Seoul in a similar way. If you block businesses or investments, then we'll get after you via a different means. So I think it's a bit of a wake-up call for Seoul as well to realize that, you know, this is a kind of a new Trump administration with clear transactional relationships, and then now they have to deal with this kind of way of doing business and diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Rashid, you just mentioned Bom Kim. I do want to ask you about the latest news we have about the founder of Coupang. On Wednesday, Korea's Fair Trade Commission designated Kim as the company's controlling shareholder. And for our listeners, you know, what exactly does this mean for Coupang and for Bom Kim?
Yeah, so for the past few years, Coupang has avoided chaebol-style regulation by keeping Bom Kim's designation as a corporate entity rather than an individual. So that loophole was that his relatives supposedly didn't participate in management. But the FTC investigation has found that Kim's younger brother, Yoo Kim, a vice president at Coupang, received compensation over 4 years and was making major decisions at the company. So that broke the exemption. So now we have Bom Kim, who is designated as a controlling stakeholder. So that means that he and his family face full Chaebol regulations, essentially, similar to the Samsung's Li family. So they need to publicly disclose all shareholdings and transactions, any company where Kim or his relatives hold over 20%, become part of the regulated group. And there are also like restrictions on self-dealings and insider benefits. And if along the way he or his family break the rules, then there are penalties, kind of criminal penalties as well. So now they're saying essentially Kim and family, you face exactly the same scrutiny as any other Chaebol in Korea.
Right, so much tighter regulatory oversight there. And finally, before we wrap up, you know, with investigations and diplomatic pressure and this new regulatory scrutiny that we just discussed all moving at once, you know, this is clearly a story that's still developing very quickly. Looking ahead, what are some other specific things you'll be watching in the coming weeks to try and understand where this Coupang dispute is headed?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, obviously, I think the first thing to be looking out for is if and how Coupang challenges the Fair Trade Commission designation that we just saw on Wednesday. I guess this is quite unprecedented, and we'll see how Coupang reacts to that. But I guess I'm also watching out for the nuclear submarine talks. Can they resume, or does the U.S. maintain this linkage between Kim's legal status and security cooperation? Are these negotiations going to go forward? What does the diplomatic front look like for the Republic of Korea and United States? One thing that I'm personally looking out for, but also personally fascinated by, is the whole identity issue of Coupang. Yes, Coupang is technically an American company, but if we go back to 2019, during the Japan-Korea trade tensions, and following an investment from Japan, Coupang issued a public statement in Korean declaring itself, and I quote, a proud Korean company, and calling suggestions that it was foreign-owned as baseless rumors. So that statement was put out in 2019. So yes, while Coupang is a U.S. company, I find it interesting how they're emphasizing their American identity specifically at this time, even though the vast majority of Coupang's business takes place in Korea, the vast majority of employees are Korean. So in a way, it's a bit like, which one is it? Mm-hmm. Are you American or Korean? And I think that question goes to the heart of this entire dispute.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll continue to watch how the investigations and regulatory decisions and diplomatic exchanges do unfold in the weeks ahead. Rafael Rashid, thank you very much for joining us and helping us make sense of this fast-moving dispute.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index dipped 92.03 points or 1.38% on Thursday to close at 6,598.87. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 27.91 points or 2.29% to close at 1,192.35. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Okay, what's our starting point today?
A driver who caused a fatal accident while driving in a drowsy state with the cruise control function activated on a highway was sentenced to a suspended prison term.
Okay, before we get into the details of this court
verdict. Can you give us the details of the accident?
Yes, the driver in his 30s was indicted for hitting and killing two people while driving an SUV with the cruise control function activated, traveling at 120 kilometers per hour in a drowsy state at around 1:51 a.m. on January 4th at the Gochang Junction on the northbound lane of the West Coast Expressway. The crash was a secondary accident that happened at a site where officers, firefighters, and a tow truck were clearing the scene of a collision between two passenger cars that had left drivers with minor injuries. As a result, the police officer and a tow truck driver assisting with the accident recovery, sustained serious injuries and later died at a hospital.
A very tragic incident. What did the court say about the factors that it took into account before reaching this verdict?
So on Thursday, in the first trial, the Jeonju District Court sentenced the driver charged with violating the Act on Special Cases concerning the settlement of traffic accidents to a suspended prison term of 1 year, 2 months with a 3 year probation period. Well, the court stated that the defendant caused a fatal accident by speeding and driving in a drowsy state. It took into consideration the fact that the defendant admitted to the crime, reached an agreement with the victim's families, and has no prior criminal record.
And Daniel, beyond this particular incident, have there been other accidents linked to drivers using these kind of cruise control or driver assistant features while failing to stay alert behind the wheel?
Yes, data by the Korea Expressway Corporation shared by a lawmaker back in February shows that even with the introduction of the upgraded version of cruise control called adaptive cruise control, which automatically adjusts the distance from the vehicle head, a total of 20 people have died over the past 5 years in accidents caused while relying on the system. 30 accidents occurred between 2021 and last year while the system was in operation. This is an incident resulting in 20 fatalities and 20 injuries. It's a firm reminder that drivers must note that the system is a speed maintenance assist feature, mm-hmm. primarily used during long-distance highway driving as a driver assist system. Constant forward monitoring by the driver is, of course, essential.
Yes, absolutely. Let's move on to our next story now.
Adore has won a court order to provisionally seize real estate assets owned by the mother of former girl group NewJeans member Danielle and former Adore CEO and current head of OK Records, Minnie Jin.
OK, Daniel, give us the details, including the amount involved.
According to legal sources on Wednesday, this provisional seizure, a court measure that temporarily freezes a debtor's assets so they cannot be hidden or disposed of ahead of court rulings, is worth about 7 billion won or some $4.7 million in total. The seizure came around 6 months after Adore terminated its exclusive contract with Danielle, citing breach of contract, and filed a lawsuit which included a member of Danielle's family.
Now, of course, Adore and NewJeans have been in the headlines quite a bit. I'm sure our listeners will remember. For those who don't, can you track back to this particular lawsuit between the girl group member and the K-pop firm?
Last December, Adore, a Hybe label and the firm responsible for the management and production of NewJeans, filed a suit worth around 43.1 billion won, claiming that NewJeans' departure and the delay in the group's return were caused by Danielle's side and by Min. And then on January 23rd, Adore filed a provisional seizure request against the two parties, seeking a total of 7 billion won.
And of course, the question on all the fans' lips, after making headlines in recent years more for legal disputes and industry drama than for new music, is there now a real chance we'll see NewJeans back in action soon?
Well, so far, members Hani, Haein and Haerin have returned to Adore. The agency is reportedly still in talks with Minji regarding her return. As for Danielle, it seems unlikely that she'll be able to form the complete group together with the rest of the NewJeans members.
Okay, so more waiting to see what happens there. Well, let's shift our focus to the final story of the day.
The final team Korea roster for the upcoming FIFA World Cup won't simply be announced through press conference or press release. It will be unveiled through a special event.
Okay, my interest is piqued. It sounds like something both the players and the fans can look forward to. What do we know so far about this special event?
The Korea Football Association said Thursday, head coach Hong Myung-bo will make the announcement at 4 p.m. on May 16th at KT Gwangham and West Building in Central Seoul. It will be streamed live on the media wall outside the building. Other than introducing the Taeguk Warriors, various offline events are lined up, including K-pop performances, as well as a running event that features participants competing while donning the official Team Korea uniform, with the Gwanghwamun Square being the finish line.
Lots of fun to be had. Well, what's the first line of business for the squad now following this event?
Just 2 days after this unveiling ceremony, the team will depart for Salt Lake City, Utah in the U.S. and set up pre-World Cup training camp there. the reason why this particular area was chosen is so that players can get acclimated early to competing in high altitude. While Co's United States and Canada are also staging matches, two of South Korea's three matches in the group stage will be played in Guadalajara, Mexico, which is pretty high, about 1,500 meters above sea level.
And I'll give us a refresher on Team Korea's road to the World Cup and also shed some light on any changes to the global game compared to previous editions.
Team South Korea, which is making its 11th straight World Cup appearance, will be competing in Group A. The Taegu Warriors will face first Czechia on June 11th, then on June 18th, Mexico, one of the three co-hosts of this World Cup, and then we play South Africa on June 24th. This year's World Cup is bigger than ever, expanding from 32 nations to 48. Top two teams from each of the 12 group will earn automatic berth in the knockout stage, and then joined by the eighth best third place teams.
And that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, I'm Claudia Cardenas, Taekwondo world medalist from Ecuador and founder of Himchari Dojang. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
We've come now to our weekly segment, Explore Korea, our time to adventure across the peninsula and uncover hidden stories and cultural gems. And joining us this week is Lee Ji-an, a reporter from the Korea Jeongang Daily. Welcome back, Ji-an.
Hi, Alana.
Okay, Ji-an, who or what are we going to be talking about today?
Today, I would like to introduce to your listeners a new musical called Arang. Its Korean name is Mongyu Dowan, based on an ancient Korean folktale or legend. It has hand-painted ink wash imagery on stage, decadent hanbok, which is traditional Korean dress, poetic lyrics, orchestration that fluidly moves through Eastern and Western sounds, and choreography that brims with drama, and it adds up to a nuanced and refreshing show that prioritizes meeting over ornament and sets a new bar for the genre.
Wow, a new bar for the genre. That sounds like a richly layered production, not just visually striking, also, of course, you know, deeply rooted in Korean tradition, Korean storytelling. Now, for our listeners who may not know this particular folktale, what is the story of Arang about?
Okay, so the plot itself is, like you said, centuries old, first recorded in the Samguksagi in 1145. The oldest surviving chronicle of Korean history, retold through the Joseon Dynasty,
Wow.
So it's set in 460 AD. It follows Yeogyeong, who is a king of Baekje, and he's constantly anxious about losing his throne and plagued by nightmares. Then in one of those dreams, a nightmare turns into a most beautiful dream where he enters a paradise and meets a woman whom he instantly falls in love with. When he wakes up from the dream, he orders his loyal servant, Hyangshil, to find her. And it turns out she does exist. Her name is Arang. But she is newly married in real life and is deeply in love with her fiancé and husband, actually, Domi. From here, events spiral into a series of violent, blood-spattering destruction as the king's maniacal desire to make Arang his wife curdles into this obsession and plain madness.
Okay, so basically, and very briefly put, at the heart of this story is a love triangle, but one that's kind of shaped by, you know, power and obsession, you know, rather than romance.
Mm.
It does sound like the king is essentially the villain of this piece. But, you know, I want to ask, how does the musical portray him? And does it give us any room as an audience to kind of understand where his fear and fixation and, as you mentioned, maybe some violence comes from?
Mm-hmm, right. So, yeah, I feel like the show really takes kind of a gamble on this protagonist by setting him as a technical device and not really a moral one, which basically means that he's incredibly unlikable. Villains can be protagonists, you know, to be fair, but the musical's king is not engaging enough for the audience to follow his line of action, especially because viewers are not given the time to understand him beyond the madness. Like, his father was assassinated and he rose to the throne during precarious times, but like that background is not very clear in the musical. So giving only a few lyrics and lines to achieve this, though it makes for a fast-moving show, does feel insufficient. But to its bracing credit, the show does not seek audience sympathy for Yeo-kyung and his actions. So there's a distinct refusal to redeem him. His actions are undeniably deranged, and the musical's resistance to soften them is, you know, I think a wise urge resisted. Still, as a viewer, this I could not understand why I had to sit through like four of his solos, which is most in the show. It's like, you know, we get it. You have issues. There is one part, though, I think that audience may secretly understand and even sympathize with at the very end of the show, which is like having a dream that, you know, collapses under the weight of reality, of wanting something so deeply, but utterly failing, you know, a dream kind of turned into a nightmare.
Yeah, as you said, I'm sure lots of audience members can relate to that on some level, maybe not in this exact context. And it's a really interesting distinction that you just mentioned there, Jian. You know, this protagonist, he drives the story, but this show isn't asking us to forgive him or even particularly like him, it sounds like. It does end, though, as though the musical, though, is at its strongest when it treats his obsession as a force of destruction rather than as something romantic or tragic. So if Yeo-kyung is such a difficult figure to follow, you know, what kind of saves the show? Because you have mentioned, you know, there are some parts of it that you definitely do like.
Yeah, no, I know I started off with criticism, but overall, I really like the show. And I think everything else really saves it, frankly. The score, the music moves fluidly between, you know, like I said, the Eastern and Western melodies, blending violins with haegeum, which is a two-stringed fiddle in Korea, and flute with taegeum, which is a large bamboo flute, and peedi, which is a small reed instrument in Korea. The result doesn't sound new or inventive. You could almost say the melodies feel safe and slightly bland, but it is executed well to achieve this intended purpose, which is to be a recognizable musical theater score with a distinct traditional sound and rhythm. One of the most memorable numbers for me was this song called "O Moon, My Moon," sung by Arang and the couple's spiritual protector, Pia, in the first act as Arang's husband, Domi, leaves at the king's command, promising to return to her. So it's sung in the style of Jeonga, which is a restrained and refined traditional vocal form, and the piece gains depth through stillness rather than theatrical excess. Gugak, which is Korean traditional music singer Ha Yun-ju, she is a certified practitioner of Kagok, which is a style of Gugak, and Yuria, who is a musical theater actress, deliver performances of exceptional clarity and control through the song. The traditional aspects of the musical can easily feel ornamental, I think, especially if you're trying to depict history in like such an entertaining environment, you know, as if, you know, producers simply added parts of history to provide a cultural flair. Sometimes it is only the facade that is traditional, while the plot lacks general historical grounding, which isn't really the case for musical Arang, so that's a huge plus for them there.
Certainly, it's a delicate balance drawing on traditional Korean music without letting it become, you know, just surface level decoration. With a show that seems so visually rich from what you've described, I'm curious about how that does translate on stage. What exactly is the staging like?
Yeah, so it's pretty stunning, honestly. It's created by Inkwash Media artist Tak Yong-hwan. He drew the backdrop of the scenes. They're all hand-drawn with ink calligraphy and then digitally rendered into a moving animation. The Tak apparently spent a year and a half creating 15 landscapes for the show. The outcome is dreamy. The scenes feel like pages from a storybook and have a transporting power. And more importantly, they play a major role in advancing the narrative. So the sun, for instance, illuminates everything beneath it like source power, symbolizing the king's obsessive desire for Arang. And then subtle shifts in the sun's position and hue were also intended to mirror his psychological turbulence. And then by contrast, the moon symbolizes Arang and Tomi. The changing phases of the moon reveal the character's inner states. The moon kind of signals the abundance and happiness. The waning moon represents like anxiety and crisis. And a waxing moon stands for Arang and Tomi's unyielding love, reunion, recovery, and permanence. So like these little details that Tak told me in an interview, they really stood out to me. And I think done in great detail. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, the glimmer of the moon against the water becomes like ever so slightly brighter when Arang and Tomi reunite after Arang manages to escape the king. And, you know, these are just like, they were beautiful details, I think, that really added to the show.
Well, definitely not just a backdrop, but, you know, a visual language of its own with the sun and the moon, as you've just explained, helping tell the story alongside the performers. For our listeners, I'm sure their interests have been piqued. They want to go and see Arang for themselves. When and where is this musical being staged?
Yes, Arang runs for 150 minutes, including a 20-minute intermission through May 10th at the Charlotte Tay Theatre in Songpa District, Southern Seoul.
Okay, excellent. Just once again, Arang runs through May 10th at the Charlotte Theatre. That's in Songpa District, that's in Southern Seoul. And for anyone interested in Korean folklore, traditional music, or visually inventive theatre, this sounds like a powerful production to catch. Lee Ji-an from the Korea Jeonhang Daily, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you, Alana.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us, and until tomorrow, take care and goodbye.
What you're about to hear could save a life. These are step-by-step instructions for performing CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, a life-saving emergency procedure used when a person's heart is not functioning properly. First, if someone collapses and is unresponsive, ensure the scene is safe. Tap the patient's shoulder and shout, "Are you okay?" If the person remains unresponsive, if their breathing is abnormal, or if there are any signs of a seizure, immediately call 119 or your local emergency number or point out someone nearby to make the call. The faster you call, the better. You can also make a video call or send photos to the local emergency number. Start CPR immediately, rather than leaving the scene to find someone else for help or looking for a pulse. Place the heel of your dominant hand in the center of the person's chest. Place your other hand on top, keep your arms straight, and press hard and fast. Press hard and fast at a rate of 100 to 120 compressions per minute. That's the beat of Staying Alive playing right now. Push in at least 2 inches or 5 centimeters and allow the chest to rise fully between compressions. If you are not trained and are not confident in rescue breathing, continue hands-only CPR until emergency medical personnel arrive. Immediate CPR can help maintain blood flow to the brain and vital organs. Acting quickly may save a life. This has been a public safety message on CPR. KBS World Radio is committed to keeping our listeners informed and prepared because knowing what to do in an emergency makes all the difference. Stay safe, stay informed.
thank you for tuning in to KBS World Radio. KBS World Radio is Korea's flagship international broadcaster, airing in 11 languages. The English service of KBS World Radio broadcasts news, music shows, and more on various platforms, including shortwave radio and online. Visit our website at world.kbs.co.kr, where you can find the latest news and stream all of our content. We are also available on mobile. To listen to our 24-hour service or our programs wherever you are, download the KBS Kong app or KBS World Radio On Air app onto your smartphone. We also want to hear from you. Visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/englishkbs and email us at english@kbs.co.kr to let us know your thoughts. Thank you.